Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we are at the end of Black History Month. We've gone through churches, Black Church. We've gone through HBCUs.
Yeah.
We've been the hero. And now we are ending on a hopeful note.
Well, yes.
That stuff was good too, but this is different. With this Black History Month, we wanted to kind of do something that was different. Didn't want to just talk about George Washington Carver and stuff like that. So we kind of wanted to end on something that is not really talked about as part of Black history. And to do that, we have a very special guest all the way from South Carolina. We have Dr. Roger Sneed.
Welcome.
Thank you. Hello. How are y'all doing?
We're doing great.
We're doing good.
Great.
So for the folks that don't know, Dr. Sneed, I want degrees like this. BA and MA from University of Tulsa, MD from Emory, and PhD from Vanderbilt. He is currently an associate professor and department chair of religion at Furman University.
Okay.
And he is also a fellow blurred. And
okay.
So this is a topic that is near and dear to our hearts. We're talking about Afrofuturism.
Yes.
Yes.
Some faith.
Yes.
We're doing a few things.
Doing a few things today.
All right. So what is Afrofuturism? Mark Derry, who's not Black, had this series of interviews with Black science fiction writers. I believe this was around 1993. One of those writers was Samuel Delaney. Mm-hmm. And in the intro, Mark actually coins the term Afrofuturism to open the discussion. Now, what he does, he asks this question that is kind of odd. So he calls it Afrofuturism.
Okay.
This science fiction by African-Americans and looking forward. But then he asks, can a community whose past has been deliberately rubbed out and whose energies have subsequently been consumed by the search for legible traces of its history imagine possible futures? I mean, to me, the obvious answer is yes.
Yeah.
And move on.
Yeah.
But he does bring up a good point in that how we exert our energy.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of energy has been exerted exhuming the past and knowing where we come from, you know, how we're attached to whom and things like that. And maybe not as much has been spent looking forward.
Okay.
Now, I don't think it's an either or. I think you can definitely do both.
Mm-hmm.
But the question that I would have is, what does it look like when a community armed with that knowledge of the past mm-hmm. begins to imagine the future? And I think Afrofuturism kind of gets at this imagining of what could be.
Right.
Am I on the right track, Dr. Sneed?
I think so. Yes. I think that when looking at a lot of like contemporary Afrofuturism, a lot of it draws on the past, both real and how we've reimagined the past to discuss or to present Black futures.
I think it's an important tool to have, mm-hmm. especially for those of us who are living mm-hmm. in the shadow of white supremacy and can't seem to escape and probably will not escape it in this lifetime.
Yeah.
The tool that we have in our toolkit that Afrofuturism provides us is the ability to imagine what that mm-hmm. future would look like when it comes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It also provides this hope that it will come. And so now we have this medium that is growing. At the time when Mark Derry did the interview, they mentioned there were only 4 Black science fiction writers.
Mm-hmm. And it's exploded.
And that was 10 years after they initially asked the question, and it was just 4 then. So now mm-hmm. we have many more contributions in this space.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Black History Month, and we're talking about something that's the future. The reason why, because I just have this idea that history's just mm-hmm. happened like 2 seconds ago. Like,
right.
Yes.
We're constantly creating it.
Right. I'm living history now.
Yeah. We're constantly creating it. And I do think that you also have to leave space for the lack of understanding how future has been imagined in some of our literature, or how it has been the idea of being able to plan for one has been recaptured in other artistic outlets. So we can see it in film. We can see it, like I said, in our literature. We can see it in art a lot. But this articulation of Afrofuturism and why it fits with Black history is that a lot of this energy we exert trying to maintain in the present. So it's almost, I mean, to me, it's a demonstration of freedom. to be able to take a moment and say, mm-hmm. this is how I see it going forward, unencumbered by, let's say, the conditions or the circumstances that I presently yeah. have to exist within.
I look at Afrofuturism as a way in which Black people get to write and speak and draw and sing and perform themselves through the use of speculative fiction without, if you will, the white gaze constantly there. Mm-hmm. It becomes a way in which you can critique white supremacy, but not necessarily centering it.
Exactly. Which is revolutionary.
Yeah. So part of that critique is levied through the mm-hmm. absence of white supremacy. The imagining of a world without
right.
shows you what could be were it not for this thing
exactly.
that we still currently live with, that the readers are experiencing. And so whether it's an overt critique or an indirect critique through omission, Afrofuturism does provide social commentary on the world of the reader mm-hmm. Consuming the material.
Yeah. And it can even bridge, you know, how do you get rid of those things? So to say that it doesn't exist, like, sometimes that future picture, it might look like the absence of the need for laws for affirmative action, because there was never a need to establish laws that brought parity or brought equity for people of color or for Black people to participate. But going forward, it's like, and what does society look like? What do neighborhoods look like when they were never redlined? What do communities look like when they were never maligned and designated to be places that are just environmentally unhealthy or unsafe or insecure or not secured? Can we see ourselves thriving in these environments that maybe we haven't occupied, or in these ways that maybe we haven't highlighted and really expanded?
Right, on? Right. And I do want to kind of note here that Afrofuturism isn't completely, like, thoroughgoingly optimistic about a future or how Earth settings. You do see some dystopian approaches, post-apocalyptic. I mean, people are now talking about horror. Again, we have Jordan Peele using horror to talk about Black realities. So you have on one hand a kind of a utopian impulse. But then on another hand, you might have an impulse that says, OK, well, you know, let's look at kind of less than ideal or less than optimal worlds and see how Black lives function in these worlds. So Afrofuturism is a wide, in using speculative fiction, it becomes a wide field in which to explore the complexities of Blackness.
Yeah, what's beautiful about that is that as the writer, you are world building mm-hmm. from wherever you start. So you could start from this reality and say, what does the world look like with these systems in place mm-hmm. 30, 50 years, 100 years into the future? So you in that future, you have a history that we know. Mm-hmm. You could also project 100 years in the future without that. And so you're right. So you do have this utopian idea, but the dystopian future is also equally probable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's some beautiful writing. Nnedi Okorafor does a lot of what this looks like from her vantage point, being on the continent of Africa, and just presenting a different view. And I love that, because I don't directly identify with that and would love to, but it's beautiful to see it to see an Africa that is in the future.
Oh, I'm glad you brought up Nnedi Okorafor, because she has, I don't know if you follow her on Twitter, she is adamant about not calling herself an Afrofuturist. She describes herself as an African futurist or African Jujuist, and being clear that what she is doing is she is centering the continent in her speculative fiction. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see, how do we broaden the term Afrofuturism? How do we, you know, begin to critique the term and its application, and who can do Afrofuturism? How do we critique that itself? Because, you know, going back to, you know, it was a white dude who created the term. And then thinking about Watchmen, the HBO series,
right,
where you had Damon Lindelof, but yes, in a writer's room of a lot of other people of color, but him presenting what I would say is an Afrofuturistic story.
Right. I mean, there were definitely elements that do not exist in this present world, like weapons and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's speculative fiction in a world just beyond where we are now. Mm-hmm. And it tells a story of white supremacy and what that produces. Mm-hmm. And why. It was beautiful. I loved it. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Sneed, where did you first encounter Afrofuturism? Do you remember?
Well, I guess I could probably go back to when Milestone Comics came out in the 90s. But if I were talking about Afrofuturism as a concept and, if you will, a thing, it would have been when I was writing my dissertation, and I don't know how I came across Samuel Delaney. I think I might have just been doing something like looking, well, because my dissertation was on representations of homosexuality in Black theology and Black cultural criticism. So I was trying to center the voices of Black gay writers. So I stumbled across Samuel Delaney and began reading his work and going, oh my God, this is a Black gay science fiction writer. What? And then thinking, oh wait, are there other Black science fiction writers? And then, you know, stumbled across Octavia Butler. Actually, in this case, I'd read Fledgling. That was the first book of hers that I'd read. Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of how I, stumbled ass backwards into Afrofuturism. It was not anything I'd heard about. I mean, I'd never heard of Black science fiction writers.
That's awesome. I'm trying to think back. I think my first engagement, like real engagement, was Octavia Butler. But okay. What I remember about it is I was reading either Dawn. Yeah, it wasn't Parable of the Sower. It was Dawn. And what I remember was kind of what you described, Roger, is like, this exists? Like, where did this come from? Where have I been? Like, why don't I know this?
Exactly.
And just, it showed me how much time I had not directed my attention
towards the future
and what that looks like. I mean, growing up in the church, your future is heaven and all that stuff. But what's in between then and now?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if there's no then, whatever. Like, there's a future to be imagined now. And to know that Black authors were out here writing incredibly articulate visions of the future. Mm-hmm. I mean, in similar ways that Toni Morrison would do in like a Beloved. Like, it's dense, it's rich, it has something to say. And with Octavia Butler, when I got to Parable of the Sower and watching her construct an entire religion, I was just blown away that they're doing this. And even still, there's not a ton of those writers, not that are reaching, I don't know.
No, I mean, I'm sitting here knowing that I was just exposed to Afrofuturism less than 5 years ago in any discernible way. Not saying that I had not seen or, let's say, heard of people crafting their literature a certain type of way. Even when you read historical literature, sometimes I wouldn't put these types of writers like Alice Walker. I wouldn't put her in a science fiction genre. But the way that she wrote, like, what jumps out to me is The Temple of My Familiar. It was like a back and forth between the present, the past, and what will the life be like for my child, my future. Even in The Color Purple, there's definitely a lot of tension in the present. There's an acknowledgement of these past roots, but then there's this break in the family cycle where a mother is stuck wondering, what are her children doing? You know, so far away from home, what is their life like? So you wouldn't think of it, or I did not think of it a certain type of way, but Afrofuturism was presented to me in a conference through a learning exercise where it was just like, what does it look like in 2030? This was a couple years ago. So the question was, you know, what does your community look like in 2030? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't stumped, but I was like, what does this mean? And really, it was just a challenge to get us to not be overburdened by the day to day of participating in community service. But what does it look like when maybe the service is working, or maybe when your plans or your program is implemented? What does it look like on the back end? And I just hadn't been challenged in that way. So this is something that is kind of spilling over from the artistic to the practical. You do this when you're doing planning exercises. But I don't know that I ever matched up a planning exercise with what do I see for myself when I center myself in a future statement or a future existence.
You bring up a good point that imagining is not strictly relegated to science fiction. It could be as you described. I know, I think his name is Maurice Broaddus. He writes like a speculative fiction, but it's Black people are centered in Westerns in the future. Like, I mean, he has different takes on different.
There's so many different ways to do this, but I could see, not just to make things up, but we're talking about speculative fiction. There's a way to build bridges. You know, when we talk about history and these broken links to a past that we don't know, that we want to investigate, that we want to codify and we want to record. We want to record these things that we find. When you write, I've always been taught that books are just a way to unleash your imagination and to get lost in a book and to kind of leave whatever is physical behind and just get lost in your imagination. This is a boon to a history writer because now you can build a bridge from a past that you don't know to a future that you might want.
Yeah.
So like we're sitting here, we're talking about this and my mind is going crazy because I'm, you know, usually imagining short stories, but I just came up with like three because I was like, oh yeah, it could be like this. It could be like this, but I'm oriented to look behind.
Well, I think that particularly Black folks, particularly because of our experience here in the wasteland,
that was a drag. That was drag them, but go ahead.
We are constantly looking back. Mm-hmm. We're told to look back.
Yeah.
And, you know, like before we got started, when I was talking a little bit about Cone and how in Black theology, we don't have a kind of articulated eschatology or vision of the future. The idea of even looking ahead or getting lost in, say, science fiction isn't deemed practical. This idea of, you know, having your head in the clouds and wanting to write about people in space or Black people in space. I mean, gosh, Octavia Butler, her aunts were like, you know, don't be a writer, be something like a secretary.
Wow.
Yeah. And it wasn't that they were insulting her. It was they were concerned about the practicalities of getting from one day to the next day to the next day to the next week. So, I mean, gosh, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a comic book artist. And people were like, well, you can't make money that way.
They didn't know.
They didn't know. I didn't know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, throwing oneself into a future time or even mining the past to talk about the future, particularly in the forms of speculative fiction, for a lot of us, it's not practical. Because, look, how's that going to help us survive? Although I have an argument. I have an argument about why Afrofuturism and science fiction helps us survive. But
well, let's talk about that. Because as you're talking about this, I'm thinking, how is that any less practical than thinking about heaven? Like if you place a hope in the future and you work towards that hope in whatever capacity, why does the future have to be after death only? What if it's future for your grandkids or just the people who come after you? Mm-hmm. Let's get into that. Why is this so important to us?
Well, I think that at least what's been driving me in terms of writing about Afrofuturism and talking about it and reflecting on, for example, like my geek shrine in my office, is that in some sense, it is a recovery of my own past when I was called a nerd and it wasn't, you know, didn't have the positive connotations that it does now.
Cool.
It was not cool.
It probably still isn't when you're young, but when you're old, your paycheck looks a little different when you're a nerd and an adult. If you're a kid nerd, you ain't about nothing. Like, I get it.
Well, I mean, when I, you know, tried to make sense of, okay, I thought at some point I would quit reading comic books, but that day has not yet come, and I don't think it ever will. Why am I a Trekkie? Why do I like Superman? Why do I like these things? What is it that these things say to me? And what is it that these things said to me at the same time as I was being dragged to church Sundays and Wednesdays? And what did that mean for me? And I was like, well, it gave me another way of seeing the world. And I think that for Black folks, we should take every tool we have to reimagine mm-hmm. the world. And like you said, not just heaven. And if that's what works for you,
right?
By all means.
Revision the hood too. Yeah. Not just heaven, but everything.
But everything.
So you alluded to a conversation that we had earlier regarding Cone and liberation theology. Can you just walk us through, you know, what you found and what ideas pushed you toward the direction that you currently find yourself in?
Well, when I began writing the book, actually began writing it as an essay. And in a sense, the essay was my way of dealing with week after week of another name that became a hashtag. I just, when I was overwhelmed, you know, after Trayvon, mm-hmm. after, you know, all the names, after all the people and crying week after week after week. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what I did to cope is Star Trek, and not just Star Trek, DS9 or Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. And then it was particularly the episode where Captain Sisko lives the life of a Black science fiction writer in the 1950s. And this science fiction writer creates Deep Space Nine. And so I kept watching that episode, and particularly have you seen it? Have y'all?
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay.
The end where, first of all, Benny Russell's breakdown, but then also that scene in the ambulance when the prophet is next to him, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Russell's like, who am I? And he says, don't you know? And Sisko says, no, please tell me, who am I? And the prophet says, you are the dreamer and the dream.
Mm. That line right there stuck with me for years.
Yes, exactly. And so I said, okay, I have to write about this, and I have to try to make sense of this, because this is my, not just a coping mechanism. At that point, I was like, well, there's theology here. So I was trying to write an Afrofuturistic theology, and I just kept hitting a wall. And then I said, okay, no, Black religious thought is your direction. That's the more expansive field in which you can work. That's where you get to follow in the footsteps of Cornel West, Dyson, bell hooks, and Skip Gates, and all those folks who are doing, or even the people who are looking at pop culture and writing about it. In some, my concern or my tension with Black liberation theology is that it doesn't have an eschatology. Cone did a great job of analyzing the problem and saying, this is the problem is how you have viewed God. The problem is that the church is an institution of liberation because God is a God of liberation. But the problem is he didn't quite describe, or if you will, take us to the promised land in helping us understand what that would look like. Mm-hmm. And that probably wasn't his job. I mean, that wasn't his job. I think what his students failed to do was take that up and engage in an eschatological examination. So, wow. Yeah. That's it's some kind of the intellectual, mm-hmm. Well, of course, the heady kind of intellectual trajectory or the path that I was, or the road I said, okay, I can't travel this road.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So where would you say, how would you describe your work to a novice who, you know, is not familiar with Afrofuturism, not mm-hmm. familiar with the formal, you know, terms and terminology mm-hmm. That we can use in academia? How would you introduce your contribution to this genre, to that person?
Ooh, you know, as you were asking that question, I just thought, what would Trayvon Martin be doing today? Mm. As we're recording this today, it would have been Trayvon Martin's 25th birthday. And if I were explaining this to a novice, I would say, that's what I'm looking at.
What
are the futures that have been interrupted, the futures that we've imagined but yet have not yet achieved?
Wow.
And how do we describe those through African-American religious thought?
You say you teach at Furman? I need to register.
Do they appreciate you there? I will say this, that, you know, for all, because we've, you know, during this month, we've highlighted the Black church, we've highlighted HBCUs, and we're talking about our institutions and our culture and how our culture runs through and is represented in these ways and other ways. And as we've been talking, I was like, it's reminding me of something, some piece of scripture. And I found it, and I just want to offer it. And it's Habakkuk 2:2. And a lot of people are familiar with that scripture that says, write the vision and make it plain on tablets so that he may run who reads it. So we're not out of the flow. I say it all the time. Spirit wants to reconcile itself. Dare I say that Afrofuturism that challenges us to think about what happens after God delivers on what we pray for, what happens after we've achieved whatever we say that goal is, that is this. So this is not outside of, you know, because sometimes people are like, it's not Bible-based. Actually, just found, you know, and you know, Mike is looking at me like, are you proof texting? Maybe. Okay. But the point is, only because I want this to be palatable, just like I said, you know, I didn't get introduced to this in a classroom. I was introduced to this in a conference. And for all that I thought I knew, I had not ever challenged myself. What does it look like once I've achieved it? Maybe on my short and long term goals, but not at a macro level. You know, what does my family, what does my community, what does my neighborhood, what is my congressional district, what does my state, you know, and not only what does it look like, you know, like we said, toward that utopian impulse, I do sometimes think about, you know, what if things don't go a certain way? What does that look like for us? And it's not all doom and gloom, but being able to work and manipulate within your imagination, within these intangible things, is a type of freedom. Yeah. So if people were not indulging in this, dare I say it was almost like a self-control. Like, we free, but that's too much freedom. There's never too much. There's never too much. And sometimes this is what our children are toying with when they say, hey, look at what I drew. Or, you know, look at this thing I wrote. And we say, hey, you know, that object can't be that color. Yes, it can. Because their mind made it that, you know, that person can't do this thing. Yes, they can, you know, because just like you can consider a Spider-Man, did a spider really bite Peter Parker? And now all of a sudden he can, you know what I mean?
Just like people got hype over that for decades. For Black people, think about that feeling you had when you saw Black Panther.
Man.
Oh, man.
That's Afrofuturism.
And like, we were enthralled because so many, well, the imagery was there, but it had been presented to us and it was palatable. Right. Like,
and see, Wakanda's not real. But
it's real to us.
But guess what? Anytime you go to a church and you see that stained glass window of a Jesus with a lamb, and it's this pastoral scene, that ain't real yet either. The thing is, so for me going to the theater on February 18th, 2018, and when the Royal Talon flew through the hologram, and I was crying.
Yeah. Same here, because
it was deep.
This is someone's
it was emotional
word. and for me, I'm like, this is what white people had all this time when Captain America was going, and the Avengers was going, this feeling.
And for as much as I love certain superheroes, I had never loved the entirety of the presentation or felt so dialed into the entirety of the presentation, down to it being hidden from outside interference. That made sense to me because, again, that to me is historical.
Oh, yeah.
If people know about the Great Dismal Swamp in Virginia, it was a place where people could steal away to and be free in the midst of an enslaved, you know, community. But nobody wanted to penetrate the swamp. Right. So only the people who felt like their freedom. This is just an out of box thought. My freedom is in the interior. The deeper I go in, the freer I become. So you had free community thriving under the nose of people who just didn't want to go in there and have to deal with the snakes, the whatevers, the, you know, whatever.
But that was also happening on the continent. So you got Wakanda, a fictional nation that is isolated against the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Because they know once people find out what they have, they're coming for those resources. Yep. That's meta commentary on what's been happening in Africa the entire time. As soon as you know, we want what you have.
Which was like some of the theaters were like amen corners, like, yup.
Oh, yes.
Exactly. But even that just gave us a certain level of camaraderie. I never felt that way about Bruce Wayne and his shenanigans. Oh. Never, ever. Not at all.
I can't stand that, man. But
I know. He is the worst hero ever in the history of heroes. Batman is the worst.
Psychotic.
He's angry. He needs a lot of therapy.
So that's what it is. It's not just literature. It's film or literature, motion picture. It's the documented hope for Black people. We lead, we live, we thrive.
We're here now. We are going to be there. Mm-hmm. Then, whenever then is and comes to pass.
So tell us about what you're writing, sir.
Well, the book, which I've just finished a draft of it, is my attempt at merging Afrofuturism with Black religious thought. And I had a mind to call it Afrofuturistic religious thought. And in some ways, the other axis of this wasn't just the episode Far Beyond the Stars, but also reading the Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. But seeing that Octavia Butler created this religion, that she herself even said, okay, you know, look, this isn't necessarily a viable religion, but hey, I've collected all the verses in the archive of her work at the Huntington Library. There is the collection of all the Earthseed verses, both the published ones and the ones that she never published. So I said, what does it mean for us as Black folks to even reimagine religion? What if, and again, this is in some ways coming back to what you were saying earlier about going deeper into the interior of oneself. That, for me, is my nerddom. And I'm like, I'm theorizing my own nerdy self and saying, okay, I keep coming back to what is it about this that means so much to me? And then finding a community of blurs on the internet and going, oh my God, there are other Black folks who love Star Trek with as much passion as I do. Okay, let's talk.
Oh, yeah, we out here.
So I'm writing this for the blurs, for those of y'all, of us who can tell you the difference between the different versions of the Enterprise, who can...
NCC 1701A.
And have a favorite one. And knew Uhura's first name before it became canon in the 2009 J.J. Abrams movie. This book is hopefully for y'all, for us. And in some sense, it's an attempt for me to... A lot of scholarship tends to be set someone else up or set some kind of theory up to knock it down and say, here's my new theory. I want to just kind of, if you will, be part of the number of Black folks who are doing really creative work. You know, like, was it the book on Lemonade, the Lemonade Reader? Mm-hmm. I mean, my God.
Heavy.
Yeah. But I want to be part of something, constructing something and saying, hey, let's take a look at these things and look at it a different way. So I've got a chapter on Janelle Monáe, a chapter on Octavia Butler, a chapter on Star Trek, a chapter on Black Panther. And now I probably need to write a chapter on Watchmen.
See, this is what I'm saying. Like, people don't really realize that they've been swimming in these Afrofuturistic waters. Like, Cindy Mayweather with Janelle Monáe has been... I've been following that story since the EP. Like, this is amazing what she's... The world that she built, what she's saying. Like, that... Oh, my God. Okay, yeah, I'm reading this book as soon as it comes.
Well, you know, because I remember when Tightrope came out, I was like, okay, look at this girl... giving us James Brown, okay, and then giving us this weird little sci-fi story. So I'm like, I saw that. I was like, oh, that's cute. Actually, I really didn't fall in love with her until The Electric Lady, because the title song is like, that is my jam. That is like, I will get out there and go, yeah. So then I was like, wait, she has an EP. And so like, I downloaded the EP and the Archandroid. I'm like, okay, no, she is now giving us Metropolis tease. Yeah, she's giving us, okay, I'm like, okay, you know what?
Yeah, Archandroid was an opera. It was, it starts with an overture that is all of this, well, most of the songs on the CD presented in orchestral fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And she's showing this love story between her and Sir Greendown, which Sir Greendown is a track on the album. Mm-hmm. She's showing that in the midst of this world that is anti-android. And I mean, it's a whole story. Like Janelle mm-hmm. Monáe was brilliant.
Yes. She
is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the ideas that we're open to. And I mean, it looks amazing when you got like three people doing it. Like you got Janelle Monáe, you got Black Panther, you got all this. But imagine if all of us were doing this.
Right.
What type of stories we would have access to if we all engaged our imaginations this way?
Well, you know, and I think this, I mean, I know I'm not, I'm not a big rap fan. I'm more R&B, but I look at some of the rappers and go, okay, y'all are swimming in these waters too, but you don't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's easy to look at Outkast and P-Funk and, you know, right. Sun Ra, because I have a chapter on Sun Ra. And I'm looking at the Nation of Islam. Or just doing a reading of, you know, this talk about the mother plane and mm-hmm. how you see this kind of science fictional eschatology in non-Christian Black religions. So I'm like, Black folks have been doing sci-fi. Even, again, look at the Nation of Islam. I'm like, okay. Yeah,
that creation story is very science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Black scientists creates white people.
Oh, the myth of Yaka. Ooh, yeah. That is some straight up 1950s evil scientist, Flash Gordon. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm here for it. I mean, I don't believe it. It's a very facile reading of genetics. But hey, that's what comic books do.
Right. Why are we exempt from
why are we exempt from creating, you know, these kinds of narratives? Yes. Yeah, so no, I, you know, so that's the book, I guess, in a nutshell.
Okay.
I'm getting it. So listen, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I mean, we could talk. I don't want to nerd Amira to death. So
that is not
it's
it.
Good to have another one here.
Well, I think we've done an excellent job of raising people's awareness that they too are nerds. You've been doing Afrofuturism. You're welcome.
Well, Amira, again, I think that what you just said about going into the interior, I immediately thought about Howard Thurman. And I'm like, oh, my God, I have to now write a new essay on Howard Thurman. And so now I'm like, ooh, okay, that's another essay I don't have time to write.
Right. Because now I'm thinking like this is a different form of mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
That,
just a different lens. Like, oh, man.
Ooh.
Okay. So
okay.
Thanks again.
Yes. Thank you for coming. I appreciate you.
I appreciate the both of y'all. Thank y'all so much.
We can do more, Mike.
All right, y'all, look out for that book. We're going to announce when it hits. Can they follow you anywhere on social medias or anything? Or
Roger Sneed on a Twitter.
Okay.
And I am also on Facebook. Actually, I spend way too much time on Facebook. But yeah, Roger at Roger Sneed on Twitter. Yeah, those are my two outlets.
All right, y'all, go check it out. Get ready. He's dropping something amazing. So get it when it comes. For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.